We'll hear case of U.S. versus Morton. And Ms. Phillips, I think we'll hear from you first.
May it please the court, I'm Helen Phillips. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Reginald Morton. My colleague David Saliba is here on behalf of Charles King. Mr. Saliba and I will divide our time, and I will address the issues of the failure to dismiss the indictment, the failure to grant the motion to change venue, and the sentencing issues that are unique to Mr. Morton.
Sounds like a continuing conspiracy between you and him.
Well, and Your Honor, this case involved a conspiracy. Mr. King and Mr. Morton were charged in count one of a 12-count indictment, and there were, I believe, 51 total defendants on this case. And there had been three jury trials prior to the fourth trial that we were involved in. And in one of the trials, Mr. Paul Vaughn testified, and he also testified before the grand jury. And after that trial, the Stallworth Baumgartner trial, he sent a letter and then sent an affidavit.
This is the perjury thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
He didn't testify against you.
No, he did not testify.
He didn't give any trial testimony against your client.
But the issue has to go with the Fifth Amendment right that they had. And we raised the issue prior to trial, and it was argued prior to trial in the trial court, that the indictment was tainted by the perjured testimony and had requested that the indictment...
The district court found that his recantation was perjury. How are you going to get around that?
Well, because that goes to the Fifth Amendment, which gives every defendant the right to have an indictment that was presented for probable cause before a grand jury.
I understand, but the suggestion is that if he were ever testifying truthfully, he testified truthfully to a grand jury, and that he perjured himself when he recanted.
Well, that was the conclusion that was made after the jury trial, and that was in the other cases where Morton and King were not allowed to participate. And the evidence
But how are you going to demonstrate that the grand jury was tainted right now in your case?
The evidence... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
What are you going to rely on?
The evidence was both gentlemen, King and Morton, were charged with conspiracy and conspiracy only. The first individual that went to the federal agents was Mr. Vaughn, and he is the only one that implicated Mr. King and Mr. Morton in the conspiracy. We're not dealing with whatever those issues were in Stallworth
and Baumgartner. I understand, but what are you relying on to say that the grand jury was tainted?
Because he testified one way before the grand jury and at least one jury trial.
And perfectly truthful.
And then he provided an affidavit, and it's within the rubric of the grand jury to make the determination. That's what the Fifth Amendment says, that it's to be citizens that make that decision at the probable cause.
You take the proposition that the court, or this court, could go behind the conviction by the jury and look at the propriety of the evidence presented to the grand jury. That's what you're saying here.
Right.
Now, that runs directly counter to what the Supreme Court said in the Mechanic case. You familiar with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what your proposition that you're trying to market here this morning runs directly counter to what they held in that case.
Justice King, the facts, with all due respect, were different because in the Mechanic case, the alleged issue that had to do with the grand jury impropriety was not discovered until the Pettit jury had been sworn. I think it was 2 weeks into the trial. And in this case, counsel was aware prior to the Pettit jury being sworn that the perjury had been committed and raised it in a timely manner. And that goes back to the case law, which is the Bastion
case. But here
case.
The Pettit jury convicted for conspiracy.
But we made
and what does that do to the testimony of Vann before the grand jury that there was a conspiracy?
With all due respect, it confuses the beyond reasonable doubt determination at that stage because that jury didn't have the investigatory powers. And the Constitution guarantees the defendant have an indictment that was presented to citizens, not to the prosecutor. The decision wasn't made by a prosecutor. The decision wasn't made by a judge.
Go back to my question. How do you know it's false?
The issue is...
You don't know it's false.
Well, and how did the trial court know which one
you
was false?
You don't know it's false. And under Costello, you can't go behind it anyway, besides the Mechanic case. Under Costello, if the indictment's valid on its face, that's 1956, the Supreme Court said, it calls for a trial on the merits. And that's what you've got here. You've got a trial on the merits, and your client was convicted. And any problem with the grand jury under Costello and the mechanic is essentially gone. The mechanic, they said, any error in the grand jury proceeding connected to the charging decision has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I understand the question. With all due respect, that totally erodes the whole constitutional provision.
But then your argument is with the Supreme Court. You can preserve that here and go up there and try to market it up there, but you'd have us overrule Costello and mechanic, it seems to me. Now, maybe not everybody agrees with that, but that's what it seems to me you're trying to do. That's an uphill battle.
I understand. If I may proceed to the next issue, which is venue. The issue in that was presented was there was a lot of pretrial publicity. There had been three jury trials prior to the jury trial that Morton and King were involved in. And the way that was presented was that this was a rap music group called Can't Stop Records, that they had formed this as essentially a cover to the drug activity. And the three defendants, Mr. Anderson, Mr. King, and Mr. Morton, were all African American. And the veneer for all three of the prior juries, as well as for their trial, had all been essentially all white. And the request was made prior to the jury trial that the venue be changed to another division within the Western District.
Well, what if some African Americans go up to Vermont, commit a crime, murder, and they're all whites in that community? I mean, they can't control it.
Well, that's not the issue. I'm not familiar with Vermont. It's,
district. I'm trying to take it a little bit out of here. You're saying the community is all white here, and that these African Americans committed, and they should go to a more integrated community to be tried.
Well,
that's an unusual proposition, isn't it?
It's not that alone, Your Honor. It's that in conjunction with the publicity, which essentially tagged rap music, which is African American, as presented to the trial court. This is, you know, this occurred in Bristol, which is touted as the birthplace of country music.
Rap music is not totally African American.
Nor is country music all white.
But
if you were to draw, you know, stereotypes, that's where that would lie. And the request would be that it
but
was
the crimes are where they are, and they're tried where they are. And in fact, that is there any evidence at the during the court here that the jury was overly influenced by publicity?
The trial court mentioned the issue of publicity in the prior three trials, also that's on the record, and said that none of the veneer had admitted that there was any issue with respect to that. But the defendants in this case were asking that the transfer be made. There wasn't
is this an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you want to transfer to Charlottesville or Roanoke or someplace?
Charlottesville or Lynchburg.
Charlottesville or Lynchburg.
The Lynchburg was 18% minority and Charlottesville was 15% minority, whereas 2.5% in the Abbey.
But the crimes were committed down in Bristol, around Bristol.
Right, around that. If I may, then, the trial court abused its discretion with respect to sentencing Mr. Morton. There were two records that were admitted, or there was the jury verdict as well as the North Carolina conviction. And there were three verdicts returned, and the verdict for Mr. Morton stated that he was guilty of 50 grams or more of crack, but it also said he was guilty of distribution of less than 500 grams of cocaine. The evidence presented at trial against Mr. Morton that involved actual drugs came from a witness, a co-defendant, Oedipus Mumphrey. Mumphrey testified that he had engaged Mr. Morton to come with him on several trips from North Carolina to the Bristol area in 2006 and bring powder cocaine. All the evidence of what was brought into the Southern District of Virginia, the Southwest Virginia, was the powder cocaine. And then Mumphrey testified about how it was mixed with baking powder, how it was heated, how it was cooled down, and how it was made into crack. So it had to all start from the powder amount. And his testimony about the powder amount was that it was 500 grams to 1,000 grams. So the evidence that was presented isn't consistent with that jury verdict. The other two defendants came out with...
What was the jury verdict? 50 grams of crack?
50 grams or more. And so the
request... How much crack does 500 grams of powder make?
I'm not familiar with the version, Your Honor.
It's probably close to the same. They add a little bit of baking powder to make it a base, from an acid to a base, cook it, and makes it into a pancake, and break it into pieces, and that's it.
But the issue has to do with, how could it come into an amount that's more? How could the crack be more if they started with all powder?
You're talking about the inconsistent verdict allegation?
Right.
That's what your contention of error.
Right.
It's based on that the jury verdict was inconsistent.
Right.
As between King and Morton, you mean?
That, and also just on the face of Morton. The King
verdict was 50 grams or 500 grams of powder, right?
Less than 500 grams.
Less than 500
right.
grams of powder and more than 50 grams of crack.
Correct.
Well, why is that inconsistent?
Because those are different. I mean, they go in different directions. One is a smaller amount. It's a smaller 50 grams of powder or below. And that was the request. That should be the offense level of 24 instead of 38, which the trial court applied. And
I
that
know,
38.
Factually, why is the verdict inconsistent?
Because the evidence presented was that it was all powder cocaine to begin with.
So if the conspiracy converted it to crack, he's responsible for that, too.
And there is case law that talks about if there is an inconsistency that it should go with a lower amount. I mean, there's a way to interpret
which
that.
One's lower, which one's lower?
The one that's less than 500 grams.
That's for sentencing purposes. That's not what the conspiracy is. Factually, 500 grams of powder could have yielded 50 grams and still has some left over. So he could have been responsible for 50 grams of crack and 500 grams of less than 500 grams of powder. Now, how you handle that sentencing is a different problem. The relationship in sentencing is not related to the physical weight.
But that's the argument, Your Honor, that the level of 24, the offense level of 24, instead of the level of 38 was applied. Is that is consistent
well,
with
the Well, if he had 50 grams of crack, he's going to get the guideline for that. And if he did less than 500 grams of powder, he's going to get the guideline for that. But if he did the crack, he's going to be stuck. That's the higher guideline, right? Crack.
Right. That's
yeah.
a 38.
And he's going to get that guideline level. Because that's what the jury found.
But we respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
I don't understand the inconsistency. It's not a sentence. The jury is not told of sentencing levels. They just said how much crack and how much powder. And this is what they found.
When the evidence was that it all started out as powder, how could the amount of crack be a greater amount?
It's not a greater amount. It's 50 grams is a lot less than 500 grams.
If I might proceed to the argument with respect to the...
Well, let me just answer my question. Isn't 50 grams a lot less than 500 grams?
But it started out as powder. I mean,
I understand, but the conspiracy made it into crack. And crack cocaine is done by cooking it with baking powder and making it into crack.
Right.
Now, the jury found that at least 50 grams was done. Morton was responsible for at least 50 grams of crack. Now, is there any problem with that finding, that they cooked it?
It's inconsistent with the one on the same verdict, the face of the same verdict, with the lower amount of powder.
It's not lower amount, it's higher. It's 500 grams is more than 50 grams.
Right.
You're talking about the offense level. But the jury doesn't touch the offense level. The jury just finds the fact of how much weight in each category, right? The judge does the sentencing.
Right. But the jury only heard evidence about powder with respect to Mr. Morton. There was no
didn't they
actual
hear evidence,
evidence
about cooking? You just said they had evidence about cooking the powder into crack.
Right.
And it's a conspiracy case.
Right.
That's what they're charged with. They were tried for conspiracy. I thought you were talking about... Your emphasis on the inconsistent verdict was between how much they found as to your client and how much they found as to King.
Well, there was an inconsistency there, Your Honor.
Right, but I thought that's what you were focusing on. You kind of took me by surprise at this.
And the only physical evidence that was introduced had to do with King, which is a very large, what they call, cookie of crack.
You're saying King was in it a lot more than your client, but the jury figured out that way.
Right, and the only evidence...
But they're entitled to do that. Juries can return inconsistent verdicts in that regard.
Well, and that's what we're saying, but
if
I may now move on, I understand the court's position. The North Carolina conviction, the Kellum case says that the government had to show beyond a reasonable doubt four things on this conviction in order to get the 20-year enhancement that was applied to Mr. Morton. that he committed a federal drug offense involving 50 grams or more of cocaine base. And I would say that, based on my earlier argument, we say that that hasn't been shown. He had a prior conviction. Well, that is a conviction of something. And that such prior drug conviction was a felony drug conviction. And that's what we take issue at this
point. He only qualified for up to how many months?
That was the 8 to 10 months that I understand this court, and I believe in the Simmons case.
We're going to hear the Simmons tomorrow.
Okay. But
Is Simmons going to decide this?
Yes.
What happens tomorrow, the in-bank court decision is going to control this issue that you raise here.
Right. On that, and we just want to preserve that. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's one point on it. Then also, if you look at the face of this
conviction. And it's a mighty tough argument. It's a hard one, both ways. You come tomorrow, you could probably help them out.
I don't know about that, Your Honor. But this conviction, it's got the language about how they're consolidated. There's one felony and two misdemeanor, and however you look at the semantics of that. But it starts out, the lead conviction is the property conviction, which is possession of stolen goods, which is not a drug conviction whatsoever. And it talks about how it's consolidated for judgment. That would be one inconsistency. The second would be the Simmons issue about the 8 to 10 months. And finally, on the face of this, when you look at that lead offense, it says the date of the offense was November 29, 1996, and the judge signed this conviction order 14 days before that on the 15th of November, 1996. Now, when the onus is upon the government to show beyond a reasonable doubt, as it does on this enhancement, I submit for 1, 2, 3, either one of those alone or all three of those together, that they didn't sustain that burden in this case to show that this is a felony drug conviction. There wasn't any support to this. And this is like the Kellum case. We're not saying that, you know, they did put on the fingerprints. We're not saying this isn't Reginald Morton. But still, it's that same standard where they have to show this beyond a reasonable doubt. And how can you interpret that? I mean, there's just so many flaws and problems on the face of this conviction to give the enhanced punishment of 20 years in this situation because of the anomalies there. They didn't show
without
the drug
weight. Enhancement, what is the sentencing guideline range?
That range, I believe, I think it's 100 to 125 months, Your Honor. I think that would be, and I'd have to go back. I didn't bring my guidelines up. I do apologize for that.
You do have some a time on reserve. I see we are red light there.
Thank you, Mr.
You can we'll talk to you. Mr. Saliba.
May it please the court, my name is David Saliba, and I represented Charles King at the trial. I am facing a bit of an uphill battle as the co-defendant who also raised the IAD argument previously had his case decided negatively as to whether the indictment that was initially issued against him as well as Mr. King should have been dismissed with prejudice rather than without prejudice as happened here.
Is that Jones' case?
Correct. Correct.
You're saying they had to dismiss it with prejudice?
That is our argument.
And that was an abuse of discretion or the judge didn't have any?
Well, it was... Our point is that the statute was amended by Congress unilaterally to allow Section 9 to give the court the ability to dismiss an indictment without prejudice under certain circumstances. Virginia,
so you admit he has some discretion?
Under the statute, if you accept
the... The Judge Jones had discretion on whether to dismiss it with prejudice or without.
Correct. If you accept
and if he's going to, if he has that discretion, it was entirely logical to the point to do what he did. I mean, he wouldn't dismiss a drug case against the defendant because the marshal made a mistake in taking the guy back to the jailhouse under that writ, or maybe the writ wasn't written right. I don't know. Maybe the government or the magistrate didn't write the writ the way they should. But you wouldn't dismiss the charges with prejudice based on a mistake, taking him back after the arraignment and turned him back into the city jail.
Given the provisions under 9, that's correct, but...
Now, if they had to put him back in there and said, he's on our ticket now, put him in the same cell, but charge us for his keys, would that have been all right with you?
It's
isn't that right?
Admittedly, what happened here, if you look at the facts of the violation, and the government admitted there was a violation of the...
No, but you would say, you'd admit that it's all right if they put him in there and said, he's still a federal prisoner, but put him in the same cell and just charge us for his room and board. We'll pay you for his room and board. He's still a federal prisoner. We keep federal prisoners in his jail from time to time. He's one of ours. We're not giving him back to you or the city or the county. City there, I guess it was, to be.
Correct.
That's right.
Correct.
You're just up here complaining about technicality. I mean, Judge Jones had all the, he had discretion. He exercised it properly, it seems to me.
Well, the true question is whether the statute, whether the agreement was amended to allow the possibility of
your argument dismissal. Is that the government can't unilaterally amend the statute to give discretion.
Precisely.
So that he doesn't have any discretion. So you're saying
precisely.
He doesn't have any. Okay, that's a legal issue.
Correct. That's what the issue is, because without Section 9 being invoked, there had to have been a dismissal with prejudice. There was
big
no
federal government can't change its side of the deal with the states.
Precisely. By becoming a signatory state itself, the federal government basically cedes its ability to do what the states could do, is what our argument is. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to work too well. My other arguments deal with,
you know, on treaties, sometimes we choose to ignore a treaty or withdraw from a treaty unilaterally.
I think that.
Isn't that what the federal government did from the states? It just said, we don't like our deal.
I guess the question is, in a treaty, is there an enumerated power that the government has?
Yeah, not only is it an enumerated power in the Constitution, but Congress approves the treaty.
Correct.
The President signs it, and Congress approves it. If they back off from that. And the same thing here. They did have a deal with the states. They decided they wanted to change. And did.
And the interesting issue there is Virginia's statute does not have an amendment allowing the section.
Oh, sure. I know. It's unilateral. You're right about it. Unilateral. The question is whether the federal government can do that unilaterally. And I suppose they call it can.
They didn't want the result that you want here.
Correct.
That's the reason they changed it. They didn't want Judge Jones to be obliged to dismiss his case with prejudice simply because they arraigned this fellow and took him back and turned him back into the city authorities, waiting for the proceeding.
I'll agree with that completely.
And so the purpose of the fix was to give him discretion, and here he exercised it, if he had it.
That pretty much sums it up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sleva. Ms. Brockhurst? Brockhurst.
May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Bockhorst from the United States. And, Your Honors, I think if I may, I'll start by addressing some of the sentencing issues that were raised by Ms. Phillips. I think that what it comes down to is a misunderstanding, perhaps, of what the jury verdict represented. There was alleged in the indictment against Mr. Morton only in this case, not Mr. King, but in Mr. Morton, it was charged that a conspiracy of 50 grams of crack and 500 grams of powder cocaine, because there was, in fact, evidence of distribution of both crack and powder separately. The evidence against Mr. Morton was that he came with Oedipus Mumphrey moving multiple kilograms in total of powder cocaine, which were then converted into crack, and Mr. Morton helped sell the crack. So the jury verdict is very reasonable in that it most likely concluded it shouldn't hold him responsible for a quantity of powder and a quantity of cocaine when they were in fact the same drugs, because the testimony was they converted that powder into crack. And so they held him responsible, presumably, for the crack that he sold and for a lesser amount of powder, because the evidence was in fact that there was a much lesser amount of powder sold on the streets than of crack. So I don't think that there's any inconsistency in the verdict. And I would also suggest, I think maybe perhaps what Ms. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but what Ms. Phillips was referring to when she was saying that the cocaine is a lesser amount is actually the penalty provisions of 841B.
I understand that. I understood what she was saying, but the jury doesn't have that evidence. They're just doing the factual question of weight.
Yes.
And what happened. So they were making their mind based on that, not whether it has greater impact in the sentence.
Yes. And I would also just clarify that, you know, Mr. King went to trial under a separate indictment, and the powder cocaine was not alleged in that indictment. So there should be no inconsistency between the two verdicts. There was no option for powder for Mr. King because it was not alleged in the indictment. Turning to the Paul Vaughn issue.
Stay on the sentencing, and do you have anything further to say on the enhancement on the North Carolina conviction?
Your Honors, I think that the government tomorrow will fully elaborate on its position, and that Simmons case will completely control this case as well as this issue and a number of other defendants in this case. Unless the court really wants, I don't have anything else to add.
Just to get the facts straight here, this defendant did not qualify for the aggravators. He was charged the maximum sentence for his circumstances of the offense with which he could be charged would not have gotten up to 12 months, right?
That is correct. According to what was on the judgment form, it's under 12 months. So
what, 8 months?
I think it was 8 to 10.
8 to 10.
Yeah. And which I think is on page 1697 is the verdict.
So Simmons is going to be dead on whatever we give Simmons.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And in fact, we moved to hold in abeyance the remaining co-defendants in this case on this issue. Yes, pending Simmons. And we didn't in this case, I think, because
we'll be able
so many
to handle
issues.
That.
Yeah. Well, if the court would like, then, and I would also just note that I don't fully understand the rest of the arguments about the inconsistency of the jury or the verdict form out of North Carolina.
Well, her argument is that there's a grouping aspect in North Carolina, which is a sort of a strange word, not quite sure what that means, but one of the group crimes is not a drug.
And I think that's clear from the form, says it's a misdemeanor. It's clear that the drug offense is a felony. I think our brief probably spells that out. I would agree with Your Honor's comments as to the Paul Vaughn issue, even assuming that the Ninth Circuit 1974 case somehow survives mechanic, which I think it's clear it does not. There was no preliminary showing, we would submit, of any validity that Paul Vaughn had committed perjury. And certainly by the time the district court denied the post-trial motions on this same issue, he had heard all of the evidence that could possibly, he'd heard multiple
instances
of testimony.
Well, he saw them several times, but the only evidence on which Morton could rely is the recanting evidence.
Yes.
And the district judge found the recanting evidence.
Yes, and had plenty of evidence before him at that point prior to trial to know that it was incredible, because not only were Paul Vaughn's letters already inconsistent by that time, but Paul Vaughn's testimony in the first two trials was corroborated by numerous witnesses, and was corroborated by Oedipus Mumphrey in this trial as of itself. There has been no evidence, turning to the venue issue, of pretrial publicity. I think there was a finding on the record that in the first three trials, not a single juror had heard of the case. There was no showing.
Well, newspapers are going out of vogue these days, you know.
Yes.
And I guess on television, you can see it.
Well, and the Bristol Herald Courier rarely comes to the Abingdon Courthouse, too. There's probably not much that was in the newspaper to begin with. So we would submit that just has no,
that
should be given no
been,
I'm sorry?
I've been to people in Bristol.
Well,
say there probably wasn't much in the newspaper.
Well, about us in the Abingdon Courthouse, I just referred to. No, there's plenty in the paper. It's just they rarely come to the Abingdon Courthouse.
It's an elegant newspaper, isn't it?
I believe so.
Certainly.
I would just note, and I think this is also fully set out in our brief, that the proposition to transfer a trial to a courthouse 3 to 4 hours away just because the community at large has a higher percentage, I actually think is contrary to all the constitutional requirements. It's just essentially, as you've noted, saying you can't get a fair trial if there aren't people of your own gender or your own race on the jury pool. There's been no systematic, the term systematic exclusion has been thrown out several times, but there's no evidence put forth whatsoever to suggest that there was actually any systematic exclusion. The fact is that the Western District of Virginia does use jury or voter rolls to pull its jurors. I don't think that evidence, I think their defense was correct, it was never put before the judge, but that is how it's done. And their own evidence is that only 2.5% of the population in the area is African American. 2.5% of 40 people on a jury veneer is one person. That 2.5 is the total population. When you exclude minors and felons and other individuals who would not be qualified to serve for a jury, you would expect there to be less than one person, meaning that most jury panels probably won't have any African Americans. And there was, in fact, one on the first three panels pulled. So there's nothing abnormal about the, when you look at the numbers, what you expect. We did not preserve this argument. I think we were not even thinking that it was actually any kind of real systematic exclusion argument. But there is a Jury Service and Selection Act that requires very specific standards to be met to make that kind of systematic exclusion claim. And those were not ever met or addressed in any way, shape, or form before the district court. And so to the extent that the argument became about systematic exclusion by the reply brief, I would suggest that that is not a tenable argument, and it really just is the argument about whether the jury panel should have more African Americans on it in a fair trial. We would submit, as we did in our briefs, that the IAD issue has been resolved by this court in Jones. The defense himself has said that it is an identical situation, identical factually, and that there's no...
You say that's law of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. We would submit that it is law of the
same case?
Even though it's not the same case?
Well, it was the same case at the time it was dismissed.
It was.
The dismissal without prejudice came in the same case, even though they were ultimately tried on separate indictments and in separate cases. All of the relevant decisions were made within the same case. It does make my head hurt to think that through, but... if Your Honors have no other questions, I believe
right,
that covers
you,
my remarks.
Let's see. We'll hear first Ms. Phillips.
I'll just be brief with respect to the issue on Simmons. If the decision is that because of the 8 to 10 months that this is a felony conviction, Mr. Morton's position would still be that this is not a felony drug conviction as is required for the enhancement because of the uniqueness of the record that was introduced in his case. And first of all, is the 8 to 10 months for the possession of stolen goods? Or also, where is the evidence that this is cocaine? Because aside from the word cocaine on the face of the conviction, there was no certificate of analysis, no affidavit, no supporting documentation that there was cocaine, that this was a drug conviction. And I think that is an essential element of that enhancement.
You're saying you could prevail on this if Simmons goes the right way, but if it goes the wrong way, you don't necessarily lose.
Don't necessarily. Right, that's the position. I just want to make sure.
You still got something to argue about, you think?
Right. That's the position, that just to preserve that Mr. Morton had a unique conviction with the...
Well, I don't understand. What was... there are four crimes on this?
Yeah, this is on the joint appendix. It's page 1697.
Right.
And it talks about how it's to be used for a consolidation for judgment of one felony offense with S in a parentheses, and two misdemeanor offense with S in parentheses. And then it proceeds to list possession of stolen goods as the first, then possession of cocaine, and then carrying a concealed weapon. Those are the three that are listed
now,
on there.
Possession of cocaine, there's a statute that refers to, right?
The government's position is that if you look at the North Carolina Code, that statute says that the essential thing is that why was it consolidated? Why wasn't there a record of that alone? There's not.
It doesn't matter whether it is a conviction for cocaine possession or distribution or whatever that says.
Mr. Morton's position is this doesn't show that. It shows that it's a felony conviction.
You're saying that he may have not even committed the other offenses. I thought he committed all of them and they just consolidated for record keeping.
Where's the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that this is a felony drug conviction? That's Mr. Morton.
issue.
Well, let's first say, is that show a drug conviction at all on there? You say it doesn't. I thought it did.
There's no supporting documentation for that, Your Honor.
What's the document there?
Is it a conviction order?
Right. And it talks about they've consolidated three different offenses.
Right.
And how do you know that that penalty, that 8 to 10 months...
Well, let's stay away from the penalty for a moment. Let's just first talk. It's three convictions that were consolidated there, right?
Right.
Isn't that evidence of conviction? Suspicion?
We say it's a felony conviction. And in that instance, if that's the ruling in Simmons, it would be a felony conviction.
No, set aside the amount of months.
Right.
Just the fact that he was convicted for cocaine is evidence there, isn't it? What page is that on?
It's page 1697. It's the sealed volume, the last volume of the joint appendix.
Now, what about the fact that on that page, the possession of cocaine is shown as F/M from FEL period?
Beside the code section, and that's what the government had actually, I believe, presented that code section 90-95A3 presented in their brief, and that in North Carolina that's considered a felony.
So why isn't this show, at least under North Carolina law, felony conviction for possession of cocaine?
Well, if it was consolidated, is it only just a conviction of the property crime?
It says all three.
It
has different dates.
And then
the date for the possession of stolen goods, November 29. For the cocaine, 6/26. And for carrying a concealed weapon on 6/26. And those are three convictions, right?
Consolidated is one. So it's one conviction.
But still, it convicts him for cocaine possession.
There's offenses.
Yeah.
And then the other argument was the date. The date on there of that occurrence of 11/29 was 14 days prior to, if you look at page 1698, the date that the defendant signed it was 14 days prior to that date.
Where do I look?
On the next page, 1698.
Right.
Is that the back of the of that page? It isn't. I mean, the back of the conviction order.
There's another page.
No, but this is actually the back of the conviction order, or the second page.
Second page of the conviction order.
All right.
And there's where Judge Jerry Cash Martin signs that order on November 15, which is 14 days before November 29. And also Mr. Morton signed it on the 15th. So there's an anomaly on the
page. Well, there's an anomaly on the stolen goods possession, what you're saying. And there may be a typo on one or the other, right? But there's nothing to question the June 26th possession of cocaine violation.
One of them's a typo.
Yeah.
Probably the day of the offense of the possession of stolen goods.
And beyond a reasonable doubt, and aren't we speculating?
The order's the order.
Right.
There's no discrepancy as to the possession of cocaine or carrying a sealed weapon.
But the Kellen case says that the government has to show it beyond a reasonable doubt, and when we have to infer that, I submitted.
Well, I think your better argument, that one, I'm not sure you aren't diluting your other argument, which is a mighty strong one, that the nature of possession of cocaine offense is not a federal felony. That's your argument, isn't it?
Right.
And the reason it's not a federal offense is because the maximum for the offense for which he was tried could not reach beyond 12 months.
Right. I'm not waiving that in any way.
Not waiving.
No.
And your argument here is that because there's some question about the possession of stolen goods dates, that sort of taints the whole document?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I understand.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Saliba?
Your Honor, if they please the court, of course, this is a rebuttal, and I don't believe Mr. Brockhorst raised anything as to the IAD argument. I do want to state on the record, though, that the Bristol Herald Courier is a fantastic paper and is filled with wonderful article
well,
and information.
I asked her the question of whether it was an elegant paper, and she said yes, it was. And I think that gives her a lot of cover. and of course, your additional testimony here about it, it will probably get a nice story.
I hope so. Thank you.
All right. I want to observe that Ms. Phillips and Mr. Saliba, you were court-appointed, and I just want to acknowledge your good service in this case. We'll come down to Greek counsel and then adjourn court for the day.